Eku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha inahe kuliana imua okea aha ho ko okolo ki e ki e hanohano oka moku aina ohoi. E nai mai, e malio mai, e lohi I e kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give you attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
All right, please call the case.
Case number SCWC-19-0000776. Mauna Lua Bay Beach Ohana 28 et al. Petitioners, plaintiffs, appellants, cross appellees versus State of Hawaii, respondent, defendant appellee, cross appellant. Arguing for the petitioners, Claire Black. Also appearing is Paul Alston. Arguing for the respondent, Lauren Chun, Deputy Solicitor General. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, as well as on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our Substitute Justice, Judge Jordan Kimura. Thank you, Judge Kimura, for being with us today. Counsel, are you ready to proceed with your arguments? All right, we've allocated 30 minutes for each side. Ms. Black, you're going to go 25 minutes for your initial argument. We'll give you a warning light with 5 minutes to go. And Ms. Chun, 30 minutes with a 5-minute warning. Please proceed, Ms. Black. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices. May it please the court. The Takings Clause balances government power to take private property against our fundamental right of property ownership. In 2003, Act 73 unconstitutionally took accreted land from oceanfront owners across the state. The state's land grab was repealed only because the Ohanas filed this lawsuit. This is the second appeal in this challenge to the state's unconstitutional taking. The first appeal resulted in a landmark decision declaring Act 73 unconstitutional as to existing accretions. It vindicated not only the Ohana's property rights, but those of all oceanfront property owners across Hawaii. The Ohana's victory also caused the state to repeal Act 73 in 2012. This appeal presents two issues. First, whether just compensation for taking more than 70,000 square feet of oceanfront land in Port Lock can be $0. And second, whether a party that sues under the Takings Clause is entitled to attorney's fees under the Private Attorney General Doctrine when that party has vindicated constitutional rights of profound significance, litigated alone against the state for nearly 20 years, and caused an unconstitutional law to be repealed. As to the first question, we submit that the answer is no, just compensation cannot be $0. And as to the second question, the Ohanas satisfy the requirements of the Private Attorney General Doctrine and are entitled to their attorney's fees. Here, the lower court's finding of $0 relied entirely on the testimony of a state appraiser who concluded that there was, quote, no known market buyer for the Ohanas. Based on that conclusion, the appraiser then concluded that $0 market rent was owed. That's in the record at 210. Findings of fact 98 to 100 and 109. And whether or not there was a known buyer that existed wasn't the issue. The state took the Ohana's land and it was constitutionally required to pay. So the appraiser's gratuitous search for this market buyer infected both his and the lower court's conclusion that market rent for 70,000 square feet of oceanfront land in Port Lock was $0. And this fatal error requires remand for a new trial to determine fair rental value, which was the form of just compensation that the parties agreed to.
I mean, counsel, wasn't that really just a battle of the experts, came down to credibility, and you folks had stipulated as to what the measure of just compensation would be, and the court weighed the credibility and everything that goes into deciding which witness to believe, and that's how it came out.
No, Your Honor, it's not just a battle of the experts. We don't need to disturb the circuit court's finding of credibility to determine that the expert didn't follow the form, the stipulated form of fair rental value. In addition to that, there was substantial evidence in the trial record that the fair rental value of the Ohana 70,000 square feet of oceanfront land was not $0. Here, the circuit court recognized that the best evidence of fair market value for temporary takings like this one is the comparable rentals of reasonably similar properties. That's that in the record at 210, conclusion of law 13. And at trial, the Ohanas did provide substantial evidence of comparable rentals of reasonably similar properties. The state leased non-exclusive easements to oceanfront owners during the exact time of the taking, adopting a formula in 2001 and using that formula for practical, all intents and purposes, using that formula up through 2013. The state used that formula to calculate rent. It's called the Kaneohipe methodology. That's in the record at 311.016. The state applied that formula statewide to calculate rent for non-exclusive easements of conservation-zoned, submerged, and fast land. So in other words, land with almost exactly the same characteristics as the Ohana's accretions. So we know that when the shoe's on the other foot, the state charges rent to the literal owner using the Kaneohipe formula. So here, where the state is the renter paying for accretions taken, that same formula should apply. And critically, even when the state is the lessor and is renting and finds that the land offers no independent value, is conservation zoned, can't be developed, requires access for public recreation, and offers no limited utility beyond the current use, it still doesn't conclude that fair market rental is $0.
Can you engage, following up on Justice Devens's question? I mean, the trial court went at length into the reasons why it didn't believe the Kaneohipe formula was appropriate, why it was sort of a mismatch to these facts. Why would we disturb that assessment, or on what basis would we disturb those conclusions that it reached?
The circuit court's findings, I think, leave one with the firm and definite conviction that an error has been made when 70,000 square feet of beachfront property is valued at $0. And I think...
But the way Mr. Leong described it, you know, it's not just... It was irregular and, you know, it was a description, it was narrow. I mean, and there's other restrictions that apply to the beach lots as well, so... Wasn't that all taken into account?
I don't think that was taken into account because those were the expert's conclusions, findings when he came to the conclusion that, quote, no market buyer existed. And that, we would submit, is a sort of fatal flaw in the analysis, because here we do have a market buyer. The market buyer is the state. And when the state leases land under the Kaneohipe methodology, again, there as well, there's a known market buyer for those accretions. And I think that's why the circuit court erred. Looking at the evidence at trial, the substantial evidence at trial, it shows that the state charged nominal rent. They termed this as nominal rent of up to $11,400 for only 3,347 square feet of land. And so we would submit that a finding of $0 is clear error and requires vacating the ICA's ruling and remanding to the trial court for a new trial on just compensation. The lower court also erred in finding that the benefit from the Ohana's use of the Makai land was equal to any rent that the state would hypothetically owe, the offset finding. Act 73 demoted the Ohanas from owners of land to just public beachgoers. We don't charge beachgoers to go to the beach here in Hawaii. And so offsetting just compensation by assigning some sort of monetary value to the continued use of the Makai land when they were stripped of all their ownership rights, the full bundle of sticks, is clearly erroneous. And there can be no legitimate offset here. Turning to the private attorney general doctrine.
Just for a moment, what about nominal damages? What's your position with regard to...
So
$1 damages.
As to nominal damages, I think our argument is that to the extent the circuit court conducted a series of analyses under the regulatory takings jurisprudence, it erred in disregarding the more generous provisions of the Hawaii Constitution And so at minimum, there should be nominal damages, but what the parties stipulated to was fair rental value. And so it should be remanded back to the trial court for a calculation of fair rental value. So in Waihole 2, Justice Nakayama explained that many worthy causes of enormous significance to society aren't protected or enforced by the government, quote, rendering some sort of private action imperative. But because those issues are often complex, time-consuming, and expensive to litigate, adequate representation is difficult to find. And so awarding substantial attorney's fees to litigants and their attorneys incentivizes representation of similarly important interests in future litigation. So in other words, the private attorney general doctrine, the fees don't just support the vindication of the public rights in this case. The purpose is also to incentivize more public interest litigation in the future. And so there are three criteria required for a fee award in the, under the private attorney general doctrine.
Can we step back one bit here? Can you explain how sovereign immunity is waived?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that the ICA incorrectly held that sovereign immunity barred an award of private attorney general doctrine fees. This court has held that 661 waives sovereign immunity as to claims against the state. And so the Ohana's complaint was brought under 661 and Article 1, Section 20 of the Hawaii Constitution. So that's in the complaint, the ROA 1. Moreover, 661.1 explicitly waives sovereign immunity over claims brought upon Article 1, Section 20 of the Constitution. And so for that reason, sovereign immunity was not waived here.
Is it? What's the nature of the relief sought? I mean, in other words, is the fact that this, you know, there can be just compensation, is that the same thing as damages? And in essence, the argument is that what was being sought here, I think, is more in the nature of declaratory relief, too. So which, how do you get to it being a waiver of damages with regard to attorney's fees?
Right. So two things. Number one, Article 1, Section 20 is both self-executing and money mandating. So it expressly contemplates money damages. So to the extent that sovereign immunity is waived, it is expressly waived as to money damages. And to the extent attorney's fees are a form of money damages, sovereign immunity has been waived as to that too. But this case here is also different because the DEC action here is not a limited cause of action. It's not a pure DEC relief action. It's brought under the constitutional provision that authorizes money damages. So even our declaratory relief claim had a component that required money damages. So it's a clear relinquishment of sovereign immunity as to money damages.
Action for condemnation, the state, I think there's an argument that the government has the right to condemn property. So the damages that are being, or the funds that are being recovered aren't really in the nature of damages or in the nature of compensation for something that the government has a right to do as opposed to a wrong that it has committed. What's your answer to that? In other words, there's something about the nature of a condemnation action, which is a bit different from other potential waivers.
Yeah, to the extent that this is slightly different because it's inverse condemnation and the state already took the land and did not pay, and that's why we're coming to court to ask for legal damages because the state failed to abide by the Constitution and pay the just compensation when it effectuated the taking. I think that's one way to distinguish. And the second is simply that Article 1, Section 20 is money mandating. Turning back to the private attorney general prongs, as to prong one, which is the societal importance of the public policy vindicated, this case does involve constitutional rights of profound significance. The takings clause balances government power against private interests, and it provides important checks on the government to take that private land. Act 73 was an expansive statewide taking. It turned private lands into publicly owned lands. It prevented oceanfront owners from registering or quieting title to their accretions, and it stripped all literal owners of the entire bundle of sticks that comprise property rights. And so by challenging that government overreach, the Ohanas did vindicate property rights of owners statewide.
Can I ask, are you seeking attorney's fees only up through the time of the ICA decision because those were the broad rights that were vindicated there, or are you seeking them all the way through trial in this case and up on to appeal?
We're seeking them for the entire case, and we believe that that's consistent with the public policy behind the private attorney general doctrine, because as Justice Nakayama explained in Waihole 2, the purpose isn't only to compensate the litigants for bringing this case, but also to incentivize other litigants to bring private public interest cases in the future, and that interest wouldn't be served if you limited the fees only up through that first appeal.
How so? I mean, if they got fees, if your clients recovered fees all the way through the ICA matter, I mean, that's clearly a substantial recovery. Then you're taking over something which is then just about your clients and the state and that particular property. Why not make that division of the analysis?
So some of that is just purely practical. I mean, litigation is uncertain. You can win a first appeal, get through a trial, a second appeal, and a cert petition, and still have $0 in damages awarded. And frankly, the state has fought this case vigorously for 20 years. And so even when the Ohanas won the initial repeal of Act 73, the issue of whether a taking, you know, occurred and how much just compensation is still a live issue. And if this case were to vacate the ICA, this would also vindicate important public rights that private property, a substantial amount of private property, in a quite nice neighborhood of Oahu, can't.
How do you respond to the state's argument that you folks were, you know, trying to get damages upwards of $6 million? That was a real incentive behind all of this, as opposed to public rights and so on.
Right. I'm not quite sure where the $6 million come from. Just, you know, through the course of the trial, if the court refers back to the trial testimony, I think it's record 52 at 62, our expert explained that using the state's own formula, calculating annual rental value for the parcels would have ended up being $7,500 for the two larger parcels, each of the two larger parcels. So it's definitely not $6 million. And you know, as to the $6 million amount, the amount of money at stake is not the only component of the prong two of the private attorney general doctrine. I mean, you can claim a certain amount in your complaint and go through an entire case and end up with far less. So when the courts look to prong two of the private attorney general doctrine, they look at the necessity of private enforcement. And here it was absolutely necessary for the Ohanas to file this lawsuit because, number one, the state wasn't going to come in and assist the public in vindicating this constitutional right. And second, no one else filed suit after Act 73 was passed. It was only the Ohanas. So they were the sole litigants. And the other component of the prong two analysis is the burden. And here the burden was significant. The Ohanas litigated alone for over nearly two decades. And this case has gone on for quite some time. And at bottom, if they had not brought the lawsuit, Act 73 would still be law.
Well, you know, I mean, it sounds all nice and altruistic now, but when the case was filed, you know, a class was certified, the plaintiffs wanted to, through that class, vindicate others' rights. In fact, those who own accreted land would benefit. And it strikes me that there was then later a shift after the remand and the decertification of the class, and now we're somehow now vindicating the public's interests. And as you say, you basically knocked out a law. But I'm wondering if, as a whole, if you look at the suit and you look at what was going on, that really only those people or entities that owned accreted land benefited from the suit. How are you vindicating everybody, present and future, individuals and the state's rights to get the PAG?
So two responses to that. And the first is, I don't believe that the court's jurisprudence requires a private attorney general doctrine fee awardee to be vindicating the rights of all citizens present and future. That is a quote from Waiahole, but that was a discussion where the court found that the plaintiffs there satisfied prong one because they had vindicated the rights for all citizens present and future. I don't think that was an articulation that that is the standard a litigant has to meet prong one. But number two, I think it's especially true here that the Ohanas have vindicated rights that benefit all citizens present and future because the Department of the Attorney General testified here that it did not appear that the legislature was aware of the takings issue when it passed Act 73. This is in the record at 313, 110 at page 122. So providing a lesson in constitutional law to that small body of people that makes laws that affect all of us does benefit all of the people of the state of Hawaii. And the fact that legislators will cycle out and a new crop will need to be educated again, I think underscores the importance of having the private attorney general doctrine available for litigants.
If any litigant in any issue files a suit and as a result of that suit, the law is declared unconstitutional, in all of those situations, that litigant would be entitled to attorney fees and costs. Is that your position?
No, I think it depends on the facts and circumstances of the case and fulfilling all the other prongs as well as being subject to defenses. So I don't think it opens the door wide for all litigants who sue on a constitutional claim.
Okay, so, but that seems to be a big piece of how you are vindicating the public's rights.
It is because this case impacted all the literal owners statewide, and then it had the educational component.
Do we have a number as to how many literal owners that might be?
There is no specific number, but it is all across the state.
I mean, isn't that where the ICA got hung up? They couldn't quantify the number?
I don't think there's been any other case where the court has looked for a specific quantity. So in Irwin Park 2, the court...
Or at least some idea. There seemed to be struggling a bit with that.
I would submit that that's a little bit of a false premise. I mean, if we look at Irwin Park 2, there it was... The rights at issue were access and continued access to a public park. And it's that little strip of landscaping that's right in front of Aloha Tower Marketplace between the building and the cars. And Justice Acoba did recognize that the public rights being vindicated affected, you know, visitors and a small number of residents that might visit the park. But there, the litigants were still found to satisfy prong three.
Is this a situation where the court should not just be looking at how many literal landowners might exist right now, but the fact that accretion could potentially, although erosion is much more likely, accretion could still occur in the future for certain lots, right?
Yes, absolutely. And not only that, it does affect property owners statewide and not just the literal owners, because here at the end of the day, the circuit court found that a wide swath of land was worth $0. And if that is the case, then I think that creates a situation where the state may feel that it can go and take a lot of valuable private property and turn it into public lands and pay $0 in just compensation. And we would submit that that is clearly erroneous. If the court has any further questions, I'm happy to answer them. But otherwise, we would ask the court to rule that the Ohanas are entitled to their attorney's fees under the private attorney general doctrine, vacate the ICA decision, and remand to the circuit court for a new trial on just compensation and the amount of fees.
Very well. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Chung.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court.
My name is Lauren Chun. I'm appearing on behalf of the defendant appellee, the state of Hawaii. Today, I'd first like to talk about why the just compensation award of $0 was correct, why the appellant was not entitled to attorney's fees, and finally, I'd like to briefly discuss our cross appeal and why the appellants lacked standing to bring this claim in the first place.
Repeat the last thing you said?
I'm sorry. I'd like to discuss our cross appeal and why the plaintiffs, the appellants here, did not have standing to bring their claim in the first place.
Okay.
Did you file a cert app?
We did not file a cert app, and that's because the ICA, this was a protective cross appeal, and we asked the ICA not to consider it if it held in our favor, if it upheld the judgment of the circuit court. So there was no error made by the ICA that would have warranted a cert app in this case. And in any case, this is regarding standing, which the court can consider at any time. So I'd like to first address the arguments regarding the so-called Kaneohe Bay methodology. As the justices know, this was found to not be credible by the circuit court. And as we also know, the circuit court's credibility determinations are not to be second-guessed on appeal. But in any case, there is substantial evidence as to why the Kaneohe Bay methodology was not a credible or correct calculation of damages in this case. Even though the appellants contend that it calculated the values of similar properties, the properties to which it applied were improved lands, which had basically illegal piers or revetments or seawalls that extended onto state land. And the formula was meant to calculate a reasonable rent to allow those homeowners to continue to do something which was basically illegal. So this was, again, improved land, not open space like the lands at issue here. It was based on tax assessed values, which were known not to be accurate. And the formula itself, what its purpose was not to be an accurate calculation of fair market rental values. Its purpose was to calculate the values of multiple encroachments in a cost-effective and time-efficient way. And to do that, it sacrificed accuracy for the ability to make these mass calculations. But that doesn't change the fact that the most accurate way to value the fair market value of property is to do an individual appraisal, even though that might be a little bit more expensive and even though that might take a little bit more time. But that type of appraisal is exactly what Mr. Leong did. And as the court has recognized, what Mr. Leong did is look at the physical characteristics of the property, its lack of access, the fact that it's subject to erosion, the fact that it has multiple restrictions on its use. And those were all factors that Mr. Leong used to determine that there was no market for this land, that its market value was $0.
What was the nature of the stipulation? Sorry. The party stipulated to the appropriate measure of damage.
Exactly, yes. It stipulated that it would be the fair market rental value, and that was the value that Mr. Leong calculated.
Doesn't that kind of implicitly assume that there is some fair market rental value?
I'm sorry.
Was it the stipulation, the fair market rental value, if any, or was it the fair market rental value?
It was if any. I believe, and it was also subject to any restrictions on its use. And again, those restrictions factored into why Mr. Leong said that there was.
And I understand Mr. Leong's expert testimony and all of the restrictions, and you know, there's nothing that really could be built there. It could only be for recreational use. There's some difficulty in getting there. Why is a finding that that had no value whatsoever not clearly erroneous? I mean, common sense, right? Wouldn't someone pay even $10 to be able to use that property for 9 years?
Well, that's not in the record, Your Honor. And the calculation of fair market rental value is firmly in the realm of expert testimony. Mr. Leong was the only credible expert that the court found. So I would submit that even if the court
is fair market rental value not ascertainable without an expert witness? Is that not something that a layperson or common sense can be used to get to what a fair market rental value might be?
It might be used as evidence, but I think the most credible way to value the fair market rental value of especially an unusual property like this one with unusual restrictions is to rely on an expert. And I don't think that the circuit court clearly erred by placing reliance on an expert like that. Now, I'd like to move on to the attorney's fees issue. And I know that counsel spent a lot of time on the private attorney general doctrine, but you don't even need to get to the factors under the private attorney general doctrine if you find that they were not the prevailing party in this case.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you just said.
That they were not the prevailing party in this case. Okay. This court's precedent, as we pointed out in our opposition to cert, says that before you get to the private attorney general factors, you first determine which party was the prevailing party. And
how didn't they play a part in this law being repealed after Mauna Lua won, after the ICA's decision?
Certainly. So the theory that a party prevails in a litigation, even if they don't obtain court relief, because their lawsuit affects some kind of voluntary change in conduct on behalf of their opponent, that's known as the catalyst theory. That theory has been rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Buchanan, Board, and Care
Why
Home.
Do we have to follow that?
Oh, this court has adopted the Buchanan case in Oahu Publications, Inc. versus Abercrombie. It says in Buchanan, the United States Supreme Court observed that a prevailing party is one who has been awarded some relief by the court. So to be clear, no court ordered that Act 73 be repealed.
That relates to what? What was the issue in that case, Oahu Publications?
It was attorney's fees. Who is the prevailing party for the purpose of attorney's fees?
But we are dealing with Article 1, Section 20, which is a yes. self-executing provision of the Hawaii Constitution. Why are they not a prevailing party with respect to that constitutional provision?
Because the Article 1, Section 20, it's a limited waiver of sovereign immunity for just compensation. And it's a well-settled principle of takings jurisprudence that just compensation is damages to the property itself. It does not include consequential damages to an owner. And that's consistent with Article 1, Section 20, which speaks to damages to property. I think the U.S. Supreme Court case that's most clear about just compensation is U.S. versus Bodka, which we cited in our answering brief. And again, that's clear that just compensation, it says, is damages to the property. It's meant to make the property whole. It doesn't include consequential damages.
Your initial point on prevailing party, I mean, they were trying to, it was an inverse condemnation, so they had to establish the threshold issue, whether or not it was a taking, and they did win on that issue.
Sure.
They got the declaratory relief on that, so they prevailed there.
So there are two elements to a takings claim, and we touched on this again in our opposition to the cert app. It's not just that public property is taken for it's not just that private property has been taken for public ownership. That's one of the elements, but a taking in itself, as we pointed out, is not a legal injury. It's within the state's power as a sovereign to take private property and put it to public use, but it only becomes a legal violation once just compensation has been failed to be paid. So in this case, they prevailed arguably on the first element of a takings claim, which is that property was taken by the state, but they failed to prevail on the second prong for just compensation.
But it says It says private property shall not be taken or damaged for public use without just compensation. So why does that not even require an award of nominal damages? If they can't prove anything above nominal damages, it says you have to give just compensation. And if the only compensation that is just is nominal, why shouldn't we say that at least $1 must be awarded?
So I have a couple of responses to that. The first is this court in the DW Ainalea case did make it clear that the taking in itself is not a legal violation. The second is that, as the court knows, the parties stipulated to the measure of just compensation in this case, and it was fair market
stipulations rental. As to applicable law are not binding on this court, right?
That's accurate, but they stipulated to the relief that they were entitled to from the circuit court.
And if they can't establish what the fair market rental is, why not? Why would nominal damages not be appropriate?
Again, nominal damages are damages for a legal violation, and until that
wasn't there a clear violation of their rights here?
No, Your Honor. And again, it's because they were not entitled to any more than the fair market rental value for the property.
Why? I asked Ms. Black this question. Why not segregate the analysis into the litigation leading up to the ICA's holding that there was a taking, and that and allow fees up till that point for vindicating that important interest, and then after that it would seem like it's more of an individualized dispute.
I would go back to the principle that you articulated in Oahu Publications, which is that the prevailing party has to be awarded some relief by the court. So what the ICA's first decision did is that it said, you know, the first element of a takings claim has been satisfied, but it remanded because there wasn't any evidence at that point that the appellants even owned accreted property, or excuse me, accreted land that was taken. It wasn't clear that they were owed any just compensation. So there was no relief granted by that court. It just determined that the first element had been met. And I don't think that there's any cases that say that once a plaintiff establishes one element of its case, it's entitled to attorney's fees.
A declaratory, a declaration that a law was unconstitutional is not
again the
prevailing?
The declaration was not that the law was unconstitutional. The declaration was merely that it affected a taking of accreted land not otherwise awarded.
So you're arguing there was no legal injury. Is that what it is? You're just saying
yes.
There was a taking, and if there is, you got to pay just compensation, which came out to zero in this case. Is that where you're going?
Yes, that's accurate. With respect to attorney's fees, I've covered.
Can you go back to sovereign immunity?
Yes.
So the argument from Ms. Black is that on its face, the constitutional provision appears to waive sovereign immunity, Article 1, Section 20, and also that particularly so in the context of an inverse condemnation action. Can you address that?
Right. So I think that goes back to the fact that it's Article 1, Section 20 is a limited waiver of sovereign immunity. It entitles a specific type of damages, just compensation, and as described and as found in the U.S. versus Bodca case, just compensation doesn't include attorney's fees. And it's clear based on what this court has said about sovereign immunity that it requires a clear waiver and that any waiver has to be strictly construed in favor of the state.
Why not? Is there a basis for differentiating between inverse condemnation and just a straight up condemnation action? I think we have case law that says the landowner doesn't get attorney's fees in a condemnation action. I think that's the Davis case. But what about inverse condemnation? I mean, it's a much different type of action. Rather than the government sort of straight up going in and saying, we'd like to take your property and we're going to pay you for it, the government does something that renders a property valueless. There's a much higher burden to prove to get there. Is that worthy of a sort of different assessment of whether fees might be, or whether there might be a waiver of sovereign immunity to get to the outcome the landowners are arguing for?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the right to sue the state for inverse condemnation is still based on Article 1, Section 20. So it still doesn't involve a broader waiver of sovereign immunity than what's already granted in that constitutional provision.
And, you know, when you think about the equities, though, you know, inverse condemnation, you have the landowner pursuing the case, and let's say they prevail and they get just compensation, the attorney's fees may exceed what the just compensation may turn out to be. It's just, what about the equities of that type of situation where you have the landowner having to go against the government?
Again, whatever the equities may be, sovereign immunity requires a clear waiver, and it requires the court to construe any waiver strictly, and strictly in favor of the state. I think if there is an argument to be made about, you know, making it more fair or equitable, I think the relief there is to have some kind of statute awarding for attorneys, awarding attorneys' fees and inverse condemnation. But right now what we have is Article 1, Section 20, and on its terms, it doesn't provide for those types of damages.
Well, some states do have inverse condemnation statutes that award fees and costs. Are you suggesting that Hawaii's absence of a statute, like, say, California, precludes attorney's fees and costs on inverse condemnation claims?
I think that is accurate, yes.
And why are you saying that the private attorney general doctrine can't be used to award fees in this situation?
The private attorney general doctrine still requires a waiver of sovereign immunity.
So beyond that, assuming there's a waiver, then why do the factors not apply?
So I'd like to, if I could, address some of the arguments made by the appellants in that regard. They repeat the argument that this decision benefited all littoral owners statewide, and that is not accurate. And what the first ICA opinion did, again, it held that any accreted land not otherwise awarded was taken, and as I described, just the fact that it was taken might not be a legal violation until...
What did not otherwise awarded mean again?
So we made this... This is a long argument. This would be found in our opening brief, I believe. But our position is that you have to go back to the time that title to this land was first awarded, either, you know, to the Great Mahele, either through a land court award, or if it's land court property, you look at when it was first registered. But you look to see what was the extent of land that was originally awarded. And if that land has eroded over time, but then accreted back to its original boundaries, Act 73 didn't take that accreted land. It didn't take land that had eroded and then had otherwise been restored. So this goes to why the first ICA decision didn't benefit all landowners. It only benefited owners who had accreted land that was not otherwise awarded, that was not otherwise restored.
So we're to ignore our common law or our case law holding that the accretion does go to the homeowner, well, basically up to the high wash of the waves. It's the accreted land does enter to the literal owner.
So
that's not an award.
So just to clarify, the ICA decision held that going forward, there was not a taking of future accretions because there was no vested interest in those accretions. So the law right now is that land that's accreted since the date of Act 73 is public property. So in that sense, the argument that the decision benefited future or owners of future accretion is also not accurate because there is, again, as the ICA said,
that issue is not before this court at this juncture.
True. Yes, that was decided by the 2009 ICA decision. And again, the decision did not benefit all owners of littoral property in the state, only that narrow category of owners that owned accreted land not otherwise awarded, which was taken. And among those owners, only those who owned land that had a fair market value that were entitled to just compensation. And there wasn't any evidence of what the amount of those owners would actually be. I would ask the court to look at the Asato versus Procurement Policy Board decision. In that case, the court said that plaintiffs were not entitled to attorney's fees because the third factor of the private attorney general doctrine wasn't met, the amount of people benefiting from that decision. And in that case, the much like this one, the plaintiffs couldn't prove any number of people who would actually have benefited. And I'd also argue that the argument about, you know, everyone benefiting because this decision, or this action was brought to enforce the law is far too broad to satisfy the private attorney general doctrine. I mean, under that argument, and arguably any lawsuit brought against the state that's meant to enforce a law, which conceivably would be every lawsuit, has some benefit to the public.
I just want to make sure, I'm sorry, I understand. So it's the state's position that based on 661, whatever the basis of the law, that homeowners, literal homeowners, the state, the public owns, when there's erosion, it's up to the high water, high wash of the waves.
Yes.
But if there's accretion, unless there had been a land award, anything accreted still belongs to the state.
Anything accreted since the date of Act 73.
Belongs to the state.
Now belongs to the state.
Okay, and you don't see any conflict between that and some of our case law?
The ICA 2009 decision said that the littoral property owners don't have any vested interest in future accretions, and that's why takings after the date of Act 73.
And that's, we have the Lava case too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Ms. Chen, can I have you circle back to sovereign immunity and ask for your response to this comment made by Judge Mulway in the Bridge Inalea case, which is a federal case removed to federal court, mm-hmm. and there are issues of 11th Amendment immunity, but she did go ahead and analyze sovereign immunity under state law, and sort of tracking through the case and the question of whether attorney's fees would be barred by sovereign immunity, made the following comment. By litigating Bridges' state law claims for money damages on the merits, the LUC consented to suit with respect to those claims and opened itself up to an award of attorney's fees against it if Bridge prevailed and proved entitlement to fees. What's your reaction to the argument or the suggestion that by going ahead and litigating the inverse condemnation action, the state had impliedly consented to be liable for fees if it lost?
So the Bridge case, I don't believe it was just because the state, you know, continued to defend itself. It's because it specifically removed the case to federal court and then consented to the jurisdiction of the federal courts that Judge Mulway said waived its sovereign immunity.
No, but as I read the passage, it's wholly apart from 11th Amendment. She's just looking at state law, and she's saying, if you go ahead and litigate these claims, you are consenting to be liable for attorney's fees if you lose, potentially. What's your reaction to that? Is there a consent or a waiver by conduct by the state in going ahead and litigating? Because that's what I'm reading there. If the state law, by litigating the claims on the merits, the LUC consented to suit and opened itself up to an award of attorney's fees.
I believe Judge Mulway was also talking specifically about the federal claims. And so by litigating, the federal claims were filed in state court, and instead of dismissing or moving to dismiss those claims, I believe the state, again, this is my memory of the Bridge case, but I believe that it removed the case to federal court and then consented to federal jurisdiction over those claims.
So where is the waiver for of sovereign immunity for folks who are seeking to bring inverse condemnation cases? Is that Article 1, Section 20 that authorizes those claims?
I think, to the extent that Article 1, Section 20 is self-executing,
mm-hmm.
It's a waiver. It's a limited waiver of sovereign immunity to bring those claims. And the state pointed out, I think it's HRS, is it 661-1 that allows these courts to have jurisdiction over those claims? I see that my...
But you're saying it's limited to just compensation?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's never a waiver of sovereign immunity with respect to an inverse condemnation action and attorney's fees? Never?
Absent some other statute awarding fees in that circumstance, yes, just based on the plain language of the Constitution, that does not include a waiver for attorney's fees.
Okay, because in an inverse condemnation case, I don't see any other statutes. So pretty much on an inverse condemnation case, your position is that there is never a waiver of sovereign immunity.
That's correct. Okay. Since I'm running out of time, I'd like to quickly turn to our cross appeal about standing. So there are two bases for the cross appeal. The first one was that the appellants didn't have any proof that they owned accreted land not otherwise awarded. And that goes to what I was talking about earlier, where Act 73 didn't take land that had merely restored previously eroded land. So there wasn't any evidence that they owned any land here that had been eroded and then restored to the extent of the original land court award. But I'd like to focus more on the second basis of our cross appeal, which is that the appellants did not even own the Mackay lands at the time that Act 73 was passed. It's undisputed that Kamehameha Schools was the title owner of the beach reserve lots to which the Mackay lands had accreted at the time that Act 73 was passed. It wasn't until 2005 that the appellants purchased the beach reserve lots, and they claim that by that purchase, they also got title to the Mackay lands. And what they've cited often is this Palazzolo versus Rhode Island case, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case that deals with regulatory takings. In that case, a regulation was passed while one owner had the property. The property was conveyed, and after the conveyance, a government agency took final action that affected the value of that property. But again, the regulation in Palazzolo did not prevent title from passing. It wasn't a complete taking of land like Act 73 did. Act 73 took title to lands. It didn't allow a grantor without title to pass title to a subsequent purchaser. In fact, the court in Palazzolo explicitly distinguished the case before it from those where the state takes property by its powers of eminent domain or where the state physically occupies property. In those cases, it said that the general rule is that any just compensation award goes to the owner at the time of the taking, and the right of compensation is not passed to a subsequent purchaser. So in this case, it wasn't a matter of the takings claim not ripening until after the appellants took title. It ripened at the time Act 73 was passed. So Kamehameha Schools at that time was the
just to be clear, what you're asking is if we rule against you on everything we've been talking about up until now, that we look at these alternative grounds to rule in favor of the state, even though you didn't file a cross app. I'm just trying to understand what you're asking for. Because they didn't have the claim back in 2003, therefore, for various reasons, they shouldn't recover. You argued that in the ICA. ICA didn't bite, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And you didn't file a cross app because you didn't think you needed to, but you'd like us to consider it. I'm just trying to make sure I get what you're asking.
Yeah, it's an alternative basis to uphold the circuit court's judgment. And the ICA never rejected these arguments. The ICA said that they were moot because it was granting, upholding the circuit court's award on other bases. And again, this is a matter of standing, so the court could look at this before it looks at any of the merits of the rest of the case. Now, appellants have also tried to argue that the quitclaim deed
that was raised again at the circuit court when you stipulated that the issue before the circuit court was going to be the fair market rental value.
We never
preserved that issue for the circuit court.
It was preserved, and we never stipulated that they. It was undisputed that they didn't own the property at the time that Act 73 was passed. Now, what they've said is that the quitclaim deed somehow conveyed them the right to bring a takings claim.
But what's the nature of a quitclaim deed? Don't you get all rights owned by the predecessor? Whatever rights they may have had, no representation as to what those rights may be, but you get all of those rights.
Well, a quitclaim deed, I mean, no deed can convey rights that the owner doesn't have. So if
you're saying KS didn't have those rights?
If Act 73 took title to property, then there was no way to convey title to that property via quitclaim deed. Now, they say that it conveyed the right, by its terms, that it conveyed the right to claim the existence of accreted lands, but a takings claim isn't a claim that goes to title. It's not a claim that accretions exist. It's, again, a claim just to just compensation, and there's nothing in the quitclaim deed that purported to convey any right of action to bring a takings claim to these plaintiffs. And again, I think the Palazzolo
case. You're saying that KS would not have, if KS had not sold this, they wouldn't have had the right to bring this lawsuit?
If they had not sold it, they could have brought a lawsuit if they...
Then why didn't the person that purchased pursuant to a quitclaim get those rights? I'm very confused.
So the Kamehameha Schools, owned a parcel of property.
Right.
That parcel of property was taken, allegedly, by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's claimed that the state took the entire title to that property.
Mm-hmm.
So the damage, the just compensation would be owed to the owners of that property at the time it was taken. And that's what the Palazzolo case says. When you have an eminent domain action or a physical invasion of property that takes... title completely to land, the right to just compensation is with the owners who had their right taken. But the owners, once their right is taken, once their title is taken, they can't pass title because title was then held by the state.
So if Kamehameha Schools had filed a lawsuit, you wouldn't have moved to dismiss on the grounds that they were no longer the landowner? Seems like you're kind of getting like heads we win, tails we lose. It's how it feels a little bit, but I want to be sure you can articulate your position. In other words, Justice McKenna's question is, ordinarily when you get a quitclaim deed, you get whatever right or interest your predecessor had, including presumably the right to assert a claim for a taking. And what you're trying, I think what you're saying is, well, once it was taken, there's nothing to give, so the landowners can't enforce that right. But you are saying that Kamehameha Schools could have come in and filed a suit?
Before they sold it, yes. Before they sold the beach reserve
lots. After they sold it? What about after they sold it?
After they sold the beach reserve lots, I don't think that they would have had the right to assert a taking. And that's only because of the facts in this specific case, because there wasn't like a different parcel for the accreted lands. The accreted lands followed the parcel that it was accreted to. So once they conveyed their right to any parcel to which lands had been accreted, they couldn't claim rights.
Heads we win, tails you lose. I mean, that's kind of what it sounds like.
In this case,
Once they sold it to the landowners, that's it. No one can sue to enforce that right because the landowners can't do it, and Kamehameha Schools gave up whatever right it had. So, I mean, I'm just asking.
Yes, again, in this case, but they could have sued before they conveyed away any of their rights in the beachfront property.
Anything further to wrap up for us before we hear Ms. Black's rebuttal?
No, thank you, Your Honors.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Chung. Ms. Black, your rebuttal.
Thank you. On the issue of private attorney general fees and the prevailing party analysis, frankly, the prevailing party analysis is not part of the private attorney general doctrine.
Can you speak a little bit more?
Sorry about that.
Ooh.
All right. The prevailing party analysis is not part of the private attorney general doctrine analysis. The court has been very clear when articulating the private attorney general doctrine that it looks at the three prongs subject to defenses. Now, this court's jurisprudence does, on occasion, engage in the prevailing party analysis, typically because prevailing party fees and costs are being sought under a different statute. So we would submit that prevailing party is not part of the analysis. But even if the court were to find that the prevailing party analysis does apply, we are the prevailing party up to the point of the first appeal. And we would submit that fees are appropriate under the private attorney general doctrine for the work done up to that first appeal. Second, Ms. Chun mentioned...
vindicating public rights or societal interest, that infers prevailing party, doesn't it?
It actually doesn't necessarily, because if you look at this case, the final judgment does not identify the Ohanas as the prevailing party, but it is indisputable that the Ohanas caused Act 73 to be declared unconstitutional. And when the ICA did that, they also said, with that comes the right to just compensation. That was in the Mauna Loa Bay 1 case. And then quickly turning to Ms. Chun's reference to the improved lands at issue when she was trying to distinguish the Kaneohe Bay methodology, I would just refer the court to the record on appeal at 317, 63 to 111 at pages 10 to 20. Those are photos of the Ohana's land marking where that Makai land accreted that the state took, and compare that to record on appeal at 311, 97 to 444, which are photos of the land that was valued under the Kaneohe Bay methodology and actually by the state's appraiser in this case, Mr. Leong, where he looked at properties that are very, very similar and found fair rental values and on a per square footage and annual rental basis that is higher than what we seek here.
Yes. I'm sorry, Counsel, may I ask you, if the court finds that the waiver of sovereign immunity was a limited one, as the state's advocating for, to just compensation, what's the avenue that we can take to consider the award of reasonable fees?
If sovereign immunity was not waived, then...
It was waived to a limited waiver, just compensation. What avenue could we then pursue, or what would we have to look at to get to fees?
I think as to, first of all, if there is a waiver as to just compensation, that is a waiver as to money damages. And under this court's jurisprudence, a waiver as to money damages is a waiver that extends to attorney's fees. The court has never required a specific waiver of attorney's fees. So if we look at Sierra Club, for example, there it was also a 661 action brought under a statute, which was 343.7. And when Justice Nakayama looked at 343.7, there was no express waiver. But Justice Nakayama determined that it would be unjust to find that that statute didn't effectuate a waiver. And since that statute effectuated a waiver, that waiver included attorney's fees. Just very quickly on the cross appeal. As to the lands not otherwise awarded, I think Act 73 is crystal clear that what it refers to is quiet title or registration. It sought to preclude owners that have accreted lands from quieting title or registering those accretions. And then that is what lands not otherwise awarded refers to. And obviously, the court only reaches that issue if it finds that the ICA decision should be vacated. And if there's going to be any analysis of that, it should be remanded back to the circuit court. On the issue of what the Ohanas received from Kamehameha schools, the quitclaim deed that was executed expressly grants not only reversions, remainders, and all of the other things you find in a quitclaim deed, but it also grants, together with all accreted lands and all rights with respect thereto, quote, including the right to assert the existence of such lands. So we would submit that the cross-claim arguments should be disregarded by this court.
Could you come back to the reasoning of Justice Nakayama that you were citing in the Sierra Club case?
Yes.
Explain a little bit more how that gets you to where you want to go in this case.
So in Sierra Club, and I'm sorry, that was Justice Duffy, not Justice Nakayama.
That's why
that was,
you drew me there for a minute.
That's why holy. Sorry about that. So first, the court analyzed the fee issue with respect to HRS 60725. Which is the permit statute. And I would submit, you know, as to the prevailing party, that is why the court will find in its private attorney general doctrine jurisprudence some references to prevailing party. I don't think that that actually applies to the private attorney general doctrine. What the court found there was that the state is immune from suit where there is a clear relinquishment of immunity and the state has consent to be sued. So the state has consented to be sued and relinquished its immunity in 661.1, which is the claim that we brought in the complaint. So that is the initial waiver of sovereign immunity. Where 661.1 is implicated, the courts also look to the underlying statutes, because 661.1 refers to statutes, I think contracts, and specifically to Article 1, Section 20. Looking at 343.7, the court said that even though it doesn't explicitly state that suits may be brought against the state, interpreting the statute as something other than waiver of sovereign immunity would create an absurd result. After holding that 343.7 waived sovereign immunity, the court then said that waiver renders the state liable to the same extent as other litigants, so it did not require a specific waiver as to the fees. And so the state's liability for fees after immunity was waived was to be judged under the same principles as those governing the liability of private parties. And for that reason, we think that sovereign immunity does not apply here.
343.7, the action is for declaratory relief and injunctive relief, or was it for damages?
It was for declaratory and injunctive relief, and provided a series of procedural mechanisms to bring those claims. And so for that reason, it didn't fall under the pure DEC action type cases where DEC actions were not found to be waivers but exceptions to sovereign immunity. And so I would submit that 343.7 is a weaker waiver of immunity than exists here in Article 1, Section 20, which is, again, explicitly referenced in 661.1. If I can take a quick look at my notes to make sure that I hit everything.
Can I ask, well, then why is it that we say you can't get attorney's fees in a direct action for condemnation? If the waivers in Article 1, Section 20, I think our case law says that, you know, the landowner who's subject to an action for condemnation doesn't get attorney's fees. So why would that distinction exist if this is a super broad waiver of the state's sovereign immunity? Why would that limit still be there if it's as broad as you think it is?
Right. Article 1, Section 20 says that the state can't take private property for public use, take or damage, without paying just compensation. And I think that is a separate provision from HRS Chapter 101, which is the eminent domain chapter. I do think they're different, separate, and distinguishable.
I see. All right. Anything further for the court?
No, thank you very much to the court.
All right. Thank you to both of our attorneys today for your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement.
Eku Iluna, please rise. Ua ho'omololo ia mai nei ke aha ho'okolokolo ki'ike hanahana. This honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.